John Kirby and his band opening up this afternoon's fresh air with his recording of It's Only a Paper Moon. Well, hi, I'm back from a two-week vacation, and the first thing I'd like to do is to thank Danny Miller for hosting and producing Fresh Air while I was gone. I'd also like to give a special thanks to Maeve McGoran and Charles Hardy for their assistance. I returned from vacation to a brand new building. As you've probably heard by now, WUHY moved from its 46th Street studios to our new location here at 6th and Race Streets. It's exciting to be here, and we all thought that you might want to share in our excitement by stopping in and paying us a visit, looking around, tomorrow, morning or afternoon. We're having an open house tomorrow for our listeners to celebrate the move, and you could stop in at 6th and Race Streets any time from 7 in the morning to 6 in the afternoon. We'll have some refreshments here. We'll be having an official dedication ceremony at 11 o'clock. The Chestnut Hill Brass and the well-known Philadelphia glass harp player Jim Turner will be here performing during the lunch hour. And here on Fresh Air, pianist and singer Bruce Mills will be performing live at 4 o'clock tomorrow. So if you have some time, why don't you stop in, say hello, and celebrate with us. Well, here's what's happening on this afternoon's Fresh Air. At 4 o'clock today, we continue the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series. Today, pianist Mary Lou Williams joins Marion for some duets and conversation. Your summer schedule may leave you with a little more time for trips to the museum, an opportunity maybe to take a closer look at some of the work in the permanent collection of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Today at 3:30, Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will comment on the museum's extraordinary collection of work by Marcel Duchamp, and also on a more recent addition to the museum, works on extended loan by Jasper Johns. Last week, the Democratic Party chose Jimmy Carter as their presidential candidate. Now it will be interesting to watch the dynamics between the candidates as they fight for the presidency. For the 1972 election, the Republican Committee to re-elect the president went to extreme measures to ensure their victory. They bugged the Democratic National Committee headquarters. Ortegate's mastermind was G. Gordon Liddy. Now that the statute of limitations has expired on his offenses, he decided to tell us about his role in Watergate and in the Nixon administration in a book that he's called Will. We'll hear an interview that I recorded with him at about 2:45 or perhaps 3 o'clock. 20 years ago, Nixon was defeated in his bid for the presidency by John F. Kennedy. Last week, Ted Kennedy lost his bid for the Democratic presidential candidacy. We're going to spend some time now looking at the 1960s and the leadership styles of three leaders of that period, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. With me is Howard Harris Walford, who was special assistant to President Kennedy for civil rights and later the associate director of the Peace Corps. Throughout that period, he also worked closely with Martin Luther King. As his lawyer, Walford had a deep understanding of the politics of civil disobedience. He had studied India, and in 1950, he co-authored a book with his wife about India, in which he discussed, in part, Gandhi's politics and how they might be applied to black Americans. Harris Walford now practices law in Philadelphia. From 1970 to 78, he served as president of Bryn Mawr College. He's written a new book, and the book is called Of Kennedys and Kings, Making Sense of the 60s, and this new book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Harris Walford, welcome to Fresh Air.
Terry.
You can look back now on the 1960s from the vantage point of living in 1980. Have your evaluations of the leaders of that time and the politics of the time changed now that a decade has elapsed?
Well, I think when I was in the midst of it and very close to the three characters and devoted to them, I was inevitably swept up in the speed and the drama, and I think getting a perspective on what they meant and what the decade meant was very difficult and would have been very difficult, and I have my wife to thank for helping to resist my writing this until I think perhaps the right vantage point has come in time.
Well, a lot of people wrote about Kennedy before this, and you quote a little bit, I'd like to quote you a little bit about what you've said about some of the other evaluations of Kennedy. You write, quote, "The inflation of John Kennedy's short-lived presidency into the nonsense of Camelot needed to be punctured, but revisionist historians and ideologues have deflated and disturbed that period in American politics, distorted that period in American politics almost beyond recognition." Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, I think when Ted Sorensen, for example, and Arthur Schlesinger first wrote their books on Kennedy, they were so deeply involved that their affection and their loyalty pervade the book. That doesn't make them bad books. It just makes them very ardent and, in some sense, very biased books. I think if either of them were writing now, they would be different books, although I think both of them are still so deeply committed to John and Robert Kennedy that you're inevitably getting an especially ardent book by either.
How did you first become involved with John Kennedy?
Well, I first was involved with him in an odd way, in the sense that I stayed up all night at the Democratic Convention of 1956 trying to stop his effort to become vice president, because at that time I thought he, having been encountered him a few times in the 40s and the 50s, I thought that he was a lightweight, and more importantly, that he was then backed by the parts of the party that I least supported, the corrupt city machines. I didn't support them at all. The people I most opposed in the Democratic Party in 1956 were the instigators of John Kennedy for vice president. I then, in 57, was amazed when, while in Poland and in Eastern Europe, I read the series of foreign policy speeches that he gave in the Senate on how to deal with communism, not as a monolith, but with all the shades of gray, including the new autonomy that was beginning in Poland and Hungary, and his support of the Algerian Revolution and opposition to American policy, which then supported France, both in Algeria and in Indochina. Those were his first twin major foreign policy speeches. And I wrote him a note saying how much I agreed with them, and that he might like to hear from the bottom of the letterhead of a firm then headed by Dean Acheson, whose head, Dean Acheson, had called Kennedy's speeches the irresponsible twerpings of a juvenile. Acheson was very much opposed to Kennedy's break with the conventional Cold War policy. And Kennedy got some amusement out of hearing from the most junior member in the firm, and began working, asking me to help on speeches, and before long to help edit a book of his foreign policy speeches called The Strategy of Peace.
What do you think were some of his strong and weak points as a leader?
His strong point to me through time, which was reflected in his sense of humor that people enjoyed in the press conferences, and in some sense elected him. I think one of the things that made the difference in 1960 was that time when Nixon was asked what he thought about the swearing that Harry Truman did, and he said that he was terribly opposed to polluting the American family with language like that. And Kennedy had this great grin on his face before he answered and said he would leave that question to Mrs. Truman, who didn't seem to be able to handle her husband's language. But I think that grin on his face may have won him the 100,000 votes that he needed to be elected president. But behind the well-balanced sense of humor, there was a commitment to apply reason to public problems. It was a deep commitment, and it was of the quality of, I think, of Jefferson's commitment and Wilson's commitment to apply reason to the public policy. I'd say his weakest point was the haste, the speed with which he moved, and that made it difficult for him to apply reason successfully, because he moved so fast.
A little later in an interview I recorded with G. Gordon Liddy, he's going to be talking about his approach to loyalty and how he thinks loyalty is the most important thing someone working closely with a president ought to have. Now, how did you approach that question of loyalty? Because I know that there were times when you disagreed with the president's way of handling policy or the decisions that he made.
I would guess that's one of the sharpest of many total disagreements with Gordon Liddy's approach to politics. A president is so sheltered from criticism. The awe of the office silences people. It inhibits them. So often I've seen the civil rights leaders whom I brought in to see Kennedy in the Oval Office after they had been goading me to do more in civil rights and how far we were falling short of what ought to be done, I've seen them fall silent when they were with the president and give respectful statements of how much they appreciate that he had done. And I've had to chide them afterwards, saying, you know, that was your chance. He needed to hear that. And I think from his aides, it is crucial that when they disagree with him, that he at least know what their disagreement is. They may not want to nag him night and day, but they should get to him their disagreements, which sometimes it was my painful task to try to do.
I imagine with the president it might be a little bit similar to the way the president has to court the American public. The president, at least nowadays, always feels like he has to make popular decisions. And if you're working closely with the president, you might feel like you have to make decisions and give opinions that would meet with the president's favor so that you remain on his good side. Did you ever feel that way?
That's part of the game that I think a lot of people play, and they feel that way. I came into this assignment as assistant to President Kennedy for Civil Rights in such an odd way that it was out of character for me to play that. I had been closely associated with Martin Luther King. Kennedy discovered that. He asked me to come in as his assistant on civil rights, reflecting the problem and conveying it to him. I think the reverse of the problem was my problem. He knew that I felt very strongly about all the things that should be done by the federal government in civil rights. I'd been counsel to Father Hesburgh on the Civil Rights Commission, and we had 35 things that we thought the new president should do. And Kennedy knew I was pressing those points. The civil rights leaders tended to think that if they saw me and put pressure on me, it was somehow influencing Kennedy, whereas the fact was that since he already knew what I thought on the matter, my saying it for the 10th time didn't have much impact, and it was just crucial that Martin Luther King himself say what he thought to Kennedy. So after a while, I really felt I was kind of an unfair buffer. And about that time, Sergeant Shriver was trying to get me to go to head the Peace Corps in Africa, which is when in 62 I left the White House. And I told King and others whom I had been working with that I was not helping them by being a buffer, and that they needed to get that pressure and their views directly to the president. Interesting thing with John Kennedy is that he responded in the end on civil rights as I had always hoped he would. He took longer than I hoped, but I'm not the one to measure his time and timing. In retrospect, his last 6 months, after things had ripened and the crisis in Birmingham and the little girls had been, four little girls had been killed in the church in Birmingham, and Martin King had gone to jail and written his letter from a Birmingham jail, and the country, the conscience of the country had been stirred. At that point, John Kennedy responded in the way that I had hoped he would respond in the beginning. But if he had done it in the beginning, when I wanted him to, it's very possible that he wouldn't have had the country with him.
What were those actions that you were hoping for?
Well, the immediate proposal that he used in the election campaign that came out of the Civil Rights Commission was that he sign an executive order against discrimination in federal housing. And he had attacked Eisenhower for not signing that order that the Civil Rights Commission had proposed. He said, with one stroke of a pen, I will sign that order. Well, when he came into office, he had very critical problems in foreign policy, domestic policy, the Berlin crisis. His narrow majority of only 100,000 votes left him feeling terribly tenuous about what he could do, and so he didn't sign that order. And the civil rights movement began sending pens to the White House with the inscription, one stroke of a pen, on it, they sent to the president. And as the first batch came in, he said, send them to Wofford. So for most of the first year, the one stroke of a pen pens would pile up in my office. That was a very, very painful period in one sense, because he was delaying on many fronts in civil rights. And it was when I left the White House, he said to me, as he had to King, I'm going to do all of these things that we promised doing and all of these things that the Civil Rights Commission has recommended, but in my own time, but you'll see that I do them. And he did before he finished.
So do you think that the delay was so that he could do it at a time when it would be popular and would be met?
No, I think that the fact is that civil rights initially was not high on his agenda. It was not one of his top priorities. When he asked me to work on that subject, he said, I hardly know any Negroes. I don't know much about this. Tell me what I ought to do. He had come out of Boston, and he had come out of circles where he had very little exposure to civil rights issues. He was primarily interested, I always felt, in foreign policy from the time he was a young man, and it just wasn't high on his agenda. And it took the pressure from the civil rights movement and from Martin Luther King particularly took the Freedom Riders and the sit-ins to reach him too. Not that he ever doubted that that discrimination was irrational and he wanted to do what he could to end it, but to make him see that this was a very, very high item on the national agenda and to stir his conscience as well as just his reason.
What did that tell you about the tactics that become necessary to enact change for civil rights?
I think one of the helpful lessons of the 60s, and beginning back with the Montgomery bus boycott, in fact, in 55 and 56, that decade, from then until the 64-65 Civil Rights Acts, you had to have a meeting of popular protest and public power. If there had been no response, if we had just stuck with the indifference of Eisenhower to the on this issue, I don't know if you have read about Eisenhower saying he, after the Supreme Court ruled segregation unconstitutional, Eisenhower was so bothered by that controversial decision that he kept saying to the press, "I haven't even told my wife what I think about it." Instead of any moral leadership, he was silent. And Nixon, when Martin Luther King was in jail during the 1960 campaign, Nixon said no comment. And if the federal government had been a no-comment government during the early 60s, the whole of the popular movement could have just been frustrated, and we would have had the violence of the late 60s without the achievement of the Civil Rights Act, the right to vote being established, public segregation being ended in a third of the country. But we did have a response, and yet that response had required popular pressure.
You worked closely with Kennedy and with King, and at some points they worked together as well. To what extent do you think that they really trusted one another and were working together for the furthering of similar ideals, for ideals that they both held? To what extent do you think that their relationship was one of just political expedience, needing one another to further their own individual goals?
As usual, motives are mixed. I think that I couldn't give you a simple answer to that. When King first saw John Kennedy as president after the election, he spent the evening with us. And as we left the White House, he said, "I had believed that John Kennedy would have the understanding of this problem that we need. He would have the skill to do something about it politically that we need, and that he would have the moral passion to see it through that we need." He said, "I'm sure he has the understanding and the skill, but after this conversation, I'm not sure he has the moral passion." And the reverse of that with Kennedy was that King made him uncomfortable because King had so much moral passion. John Kennedy, for me, was much more in the mold of Franklin Roosevelt. And you may remember the story about Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor. Eleanor Roosevelt had a great deal of moral passion, and she pursued Franklin with it to get him to do what she thought he ought to do, particularly in civil rights. And they said that Franklin, when he heard Eleanor coming down the corridor of the White House, would wheel his wheelchair as fast as he could the other way. And I think in some sense Kennedy would have liked to have gone the other way when King was coming. But he knew he couldn't, and he didn't. And in the end, King said that he respected John Kennedy and would have supported him for president a second term because John Kennedy, as he once promised, was responsible. He responded in the active sense, and that King felt that he had the great ability to respond, which is, I think, a central part of what Franklin Roosevelt had.
There was a phone call that was made in, 1960, I think it was, of John Kennedy to Coretta Scott King at a time when Martin Luther King was imprisoned for, he was sentenced to hard labor for 6 months or something.
For driving
for
with an out-of-state
violation.
Driver's license. It was a straight racial sentence, a scandal that had stirred the whole world.
And as you describe it, she was very afraid that he would either be murdered or severely injured during his period of imprisonment.
She had had dreams of Martin King being killed from the first time my wife and I met her in about 56.
Well, tell us the story of the phone call that was made by Kennedy to Coretta King, largely on your urging.
It's been told in two opposite ways, neither of which is accurate. It was told first by Theodore White as a key determinant of Kennedy's election, as an example of how the well-oiled, efficient Kennedy machine calculated that this would do them great good in the election, and that after the suggestion had come from me through Sergeant Shriver to Kennedy, the high command thought it through, and in unison, Brother Bobby called the judge in Georgia to get King off after John Kennedy had called Mrs. King. Then it secondly has been told, also in fact by White in his much later book, In Search of History, after he had studied some of the oral history on this, as a kind of pure act of spontaneous outrage at what had happened to King and of sympathy for Mrs. King, and that despite the consequences, John Kennedy called Mrs. King. Now, the truth, as I try to tell it in one of the chapters of Kennedy's and King's, the truth is that Kennedy was offended and bothered that King was arrested. He wanted to do something. We had drafted a number of statements that he would make. The governor of Georgia had said, if you don't get that son of a gun out of, if you don't make any statement, I'll get that son of a gun out of jail, but no public statement. And Kennedy called me and said, I've made that agreement. The governor is going to get King out, and that's what we most want, isn't it? I said, yes, of course. And then still, however, with Mrs. King so upset, with the country so upset, with this as an issue that was polarizing the country, and particularly black people, and pointing out to them that the Southern Democrats were the members of the Kennedy's party had put King in jail, it was very important, it seemed to us, that he show where he stood on this, and not just privately behind the scenes. And so the idea came to call Mrs. King. She was pregnant, and she was terribly, as you say, she was full of fear. And Shriver, who took the idea to Kennedy, saw Sorensen, Salinger, O'Brien, O'Donnell, and company there, and he said, if I bring it up in the group, there'll be a committee meeting on it, and it will never happen. So he waited until Sorensen went in to write a speech, and Salinger went out to the press, and O'Donnell went into the bathroom, and they were alone together, and Shriver said, have you ever thought of just calling Mrs. King and expressing your sympathy? Which he did. Kennedy grinned and said, it's a good idea. Do you have her number? And Shriver gave the number. Now, I'm sure that lots of motives were mixed, but it was a spontaneous action, a responding action at that moment. Then, at first, Robert Kennedy called me and Louis Martin, who was my chief colleague, a black newspaper man, a great man with wisdom and humor, who's now Carter's chief black advisor in the White House. He called Louis Martin and me, and he said, you bomb throwers in the civil rights section, you're going to close shop, you're not going to do anything more. Three Southern governors had said that if my brother supports Martin Luther King, they're going to throw their states to Nixon. You've probably lost the election, and you've ruined everything. You know, get out of here. And about 24 hours later, the wire services said that a brother of Kennedy had called the judge to get King out of jail. And press people called me and said, you know, which brother? I couldn't think of one. I knew Bobby wouldn't. Ted Kennedy was out running involved in the West Coast campaign and knew nothing about civil rights. I didn't think it could be the brother-in-law Shriver because we were working closely together and he hadn't mentioned it. So I said, it can't be true. A few minutes later, Bob Kennedy calls and said, would you mind drafting a statement explaining why I called that judge in Georgia earlier today? And I said, how could you possibly have done it after what you said to us yesterday? He said, well, I just went up on the plane to New York and I started thinking about that damn, he went on at some censorious length to insult this judge, this crackers judge, putting a decent American like Martin Luther King in jail and screwing up my brother's presidential campaign and embarrassing this country before the world. And I got that judge on the phone and I said, if you're a good American, you'll get Martin Luther King out by sunset. Now, that's not quite either of the first stories.
What did you write? He asked you to draft an explanation.
We drafted a statement saying that Robert Kennedy had called the judge to inquire about Martin Luther King's constitutional right to bail. And the judge let King out of jail. And the interesting thing is that, this I didn't know at the time, but that judge, who you might think would be very irritated with Robert Kennedy, who'd used his power such as it was, that judge later came up and visited Robert Kennedy and conveyed to him that he was very glad that Kennedy had given him a peg that enabled him to get King out of jail, and they became friends.
So from this story, it sounds like maybe Robert Kennedy had some of the what you describe as being moral passion that John Kennedy lacked.
Moral passion Bob Kennedy had from the beginning. I first encountered him when he had just come back from Russia, and I was about to go there. And he had come back having traveled with Justice Douglas of the Supreme Court. And he had come back an ardent, cold warrior, thinking that spies had persecuted him. He was really quite close to Joe McCarthy's view of the world in the mid-50s. Everything was measured by how you would destroy communism. For me, that was a narrow view of the world. I had been an anti-communist long enough to realize that the problem was much bigger than stopping communism in the world. Bob Kennedy later came to, as good an understanding of the forces in the world and the revolutionary problems and the third world and the North-South problem and any problem that you want to name. I think Bob in his last years had come to. The moral passion he always had, what changed in Bob Kennedy was his understanding. And whereas I think he originally asked the moral question, is this right or is it wrong, in a very black and white way, by the time he died, he asked it in a most complex, sophisticated way, but he had that rare quality, which is, I think, all too rare in Washington, of asking the question, is this right, is it wrong? And it first came to the fore in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when all the geopoliticians and the brightest and the best were assembled around the room, and the majority of them were ready to, in effect, commit a Pearl Harbor, to send American planes in and to have a first strike against Cuba, which might have meant World War III. And Bob Kennedy was the one person who stood against them, indeed against Dean Acheson, whom he thought was the most articulate, powerful, persuasive man he'd ever known. And Acheson had given this analytical, powerful argument for a first strike against Cuba. And Bob Kennedy said it was the hardest thing he ever did. But he stood up against Acheson and asked what in that kind of a conclave is always embarrassing, asked the moral question, can we do it as a nation? Would we win the world and lose our soul? And that's a quality that's very rare in Washington.
Now, a lot has been written and speculated about lately pertaining to the Kennedys' knowledge of and involvement in the attempt to assassinate Castro. What do you think was their input into that process of decision-making?
The problem with dealing with a secret state like the CIA or the FBI is that you're left not knowing for sure. Most of the trail in most important things is not in documents. It appears, though, that Robert Kennedy learned in the spring of 1962, he learned, to his horror, that the CIA had made an agreement, contract, with two mafia leaders, Giancana and Rosselli, to kill Castro. Now, that contract had been made under the Eisenhower administration in the last months of the Eisenhower administration. The effort to kill Castro, that and others, had gone on under the Kennedy administration. There's no evidence that either John or Robert Kennedy, or even that McCone, the head of the CIA, knew that these plots were going on. There is evidence that his predecessor, Alan Dulles, had known about it. But it appears that they did not tell the president. Their testimony before the Church Committee, the combined testimony adds up, I think, to the CIA feeling that they had the authority to do such things and feeling that the President of the United States should not know about such things so that they might be able to deny it with a straight face. They called it the doctrine of plausible deniability. Well, it had led to this horrendous fact, as far as Bob Kennedy was concerned, that the CIA had made a pact with the devil. For with Bob Kennedy, the organized crime in the United States, about which he had written his first book, The Enemy Within, after his rackets investigation in the late 50s, was the most evil force in America, the most terrible force, and he found his own government was linked up with it.
We've also been learning about Herbert Hoover's attempt to undermine the career and reputation of Martin Luther King.
That's an incredible story that I go into in detail, along with the CIA mafia story in this book of Kennedys and Kings. Hoover, I was able to show from the mid-50s, unlike the conventional story, which is in the early 60s, or in fact in the fall of 63, he began wiretapping Martin Luther King. From direct evidence, I know that that kind of electronic surveillance had begun as far back as 57 and 58, and it went on right until King's death. It took forms such as when the Archbishop of Chicago had lined up behind King's first great northern effort in that city. Hoover sent a special agent out to give the Archbishop a whole set of lies about King that he concocted, which succeeded in cooling the Archbishop and having him withdraw his support from the King effort, and maybe made a great difference in that city.
How were these lies delivered? By whom and in what form?
By an FBI agent who went to see the Archbishop and purported to say that the following behavior of King, both personally and in regard to an alleged communist in his movement, they had discovered through wiretaps. In retrospect, the evidence now shows that neither of those stories that were given to the Archbishop and given to newspaper editors and others, neither probably were true.
And he presented himself as a member of the FBI.
He was coming straight from J. Edgar Hoover.
You say that Hoover also tried...
This isn't, by the way, just sort of a fantasy of mine. I, in the late 60s, with our students at the college I was heading in New York then, Old Westbury, while charges about the FBI were made, I said it couldn't possibly be true. They would never have done anything like that. Then, unfortunately, in the church committee, we learned that they did. And it's documented. It's the memorandums are in the record. It's incredible what was left in the record, and it makes you wonder what was done that wasn't written.
What has this done to your faith in our government?
Well, it certainly has made me want to cry the alarm against the secret states of the CIA and the FBI, and to feel that getting them accountable is a crucial political step we still probably have not adequately taken. The whole of the appraisal of the 60s, which I do in this book, does not leave me cynical. In fact, in a way, I wrote the book because the misreading of the 60s as a time of disillusionment, or a time that should make you disillusioned, I think has produced the cynicism that makes it so hard for anyone, including Jimmy Carter, to be a successful president. I think that the 60s can now be looked at as a whole, and as such, the good and the bad weighed together make a much more important story than either the period when we thought all was bright and beautiful, like that sunny day of the Kennedy inauguration, or that everything was horrible, such as in the mess of the Democratic Convention of 68, which I write about. The fact that Robert Kennedy, for example, came to know these terrible facts and to carry that secret burden till the end of his life, and even to cover it up before the Warren Commission, the fact that King wrestled with many things, including his own messianism, when you add all that together, you get something, you know, much more important in terms of a legend that we can believe. It isn't a simple one. The men were flawed. But if you think of the heroes in history, heroes, by definition, in classical terms, have great flaws that sometimes help bring them down. And you learn from it.
What were the burdens that Robert Kennedy carried around that you referred to?
Well, the biggest one, I think, is I've already said, is that knowledge of the CIA contract with the mafia and the effort to kill Castro. Bob Kennedy, I think, out of that experience and other experiences, came to see that you don't use any means to get your ends. As a young man, he was ready, I think, to do anything to accomplish his goals, which he thought were so righteous. As he got older, he was very concerned that the means used be peaceful and reasonable, and that they don't backfire, that you don't sow the seeds that will reap a whirlwind. And I think after his brother was killed, he felt that in some sense, poetically, if not actually, the effort to kill a foreign head of state by our government had, and the use of the CIA, and I would add the whole FBI story, which he was beginning to know of what really evil things J. Edgar Hoover had done and was doing, I think that knowledge is what led him to be such a proponent of peace and reasonable means.
There's been a lot of writing lately about the private lives and made for television specials, also movies, about the private lives of John Kennedy and of Martin Luther King. And part of that speculation is always, did they cheat on their wives? To what extent? What kinds of women did they like? If they were having a mistress at the time, did they confide in them political information that we citizens of America should know about? Do you think that it's fair for the sexual lives to be investigated in that kind of way by the press or by fiction writers or people who are making made-for-TV movies?
Fair, of course, is a hard test to put to history, because particularly once someone is dead, in a way they're fair game from then on, whatever their public record is. I wrestle quite a bit with how much of that was relevant and worth going into and finding the truth or falsity of. And I didn't go into it very much, except in connection with the mafia friend of Sam Giancana's, who also had some kind of a relationship with the president. And that, for example, it seems to me, is important, because here John Kennedy had imprudently developed some kind of a relationship, and what we don't know, because she, Judith Campbell Exner, tells her story after John Kennedy is dead. She admits her loyalty was to Sam Giancana of the mafia. She may have been in the mafia's employ right through the writing of her book. She's hardly someone whose story, as she tells it, leaves her with great credibility. And yet that's what history is left with on that story. Nevertheless, there were these many phone calls to the White House. There was a relationship. It appeared to end the day that J. Edgar Hoover presented the dossier to the president that showed that this woman was at the same time the mistress of, very close, living with Sam Giancana. To think of the blackmail that gave, less important than the blackmail of the CIA assassination plots, that gave the mafia. Now, Robert Kennedy, one has to add, did not yield to whatever blackmail the mafia used. He proceeded to pursue Sam Giancana, to prosecute him, to persecute him, according to Giancana, with all the power of the Justice Department as long as he was Attorney General. I think Bob Kennedy wondered and brooded over whether the mafia was behind the assassination of his brother. In fact, we know he worried that it may have been, and that his own pursuing of the mafia leaders, especially Sam Giancana, might not have been behind Oswald. Bob Kennedy wondered whether some wild remnant of the CIA that had been involved in the Bay of Pigs and that felt that Kennedy had betrayed them in not destroying Castro, in stopping the assassination plots. He also worried about that enough so that at one point he asked his close friend, the head of the CIA, John McCone, did any of them kill my brother? He said McCone told him in a way that he believed they didn't. We now know that they had not even told McCone, as he testified before the church committee, about the assassination plot, so that McCone isn't able to. That's the awful thing about the power that you let loose when you go the route of the CIA. The accountability is lost.
What are some of the questions that you think still need to be answered concerning the assassination of John Kennedy?
I think the trail into the mafia is the great question that the assassination committee was deep into and hot in pursuit of when it ran out of money. I don't know that the truth will ever be known. And I don't start by one who tends to believe that there was a conspiracy. I think it is clear that the mafia leaders had the means and the motive But it's very, very possible that Oswald was a madman who picked up from his antenna some of the madness that was in the air. Also that whatever his personal problems were, they spilled over upon a public figure who was identified partly because of some of these very things we're talking about. Oswald was believed himself purported to be a supporter of Castro. He had very possibly read Castro's statement that the U.S. was trying to kill him in the fall of 63, and that if the U.S. kept doing it, they'd pay a price, that it would happen to their own leaders. But I think that the purpose, I'm much more interested in what is behind it and what the lessons are than the whodunit part of the assassination problem.
Let me ask you then, what do you think? Well, I guess you've actually answered that for us already, some of the lessons of the 60s. I'm wondering what you did with your personal grief and outrage when three people who you work with and had great respect and admiration for, the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King, were all assassinated. I mean, it's a hard thing whenever anyone close to you dies, but three important figures all close to you being assassinated, how does one deal with that?
Robert Kennedy turned to Greek plays, Greek tragedies. Jacqueline Kennedy gave him Edith Hamilton's The Greek Way, and that led him into reading every Greek tragedy. Read them so well that when Martin Luther King died, he was able to stand up on that truck in Indianapolis and tell the black people of the ghetto of Indianapolis, Martin Luther King has been killed, and to quote that magnificent passage from Aeschylus about taming the savageness of men, and that grief comes drop by drop upon our heart until in God's good time we learn wisdom. And I think that for me, too, in a way, the three deaths helped me see things as tragedies and to get some of the benefit of tragedy in the end, not right away, after the pain. And for me, in a sense, it was 10, 12 years after Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King died that I had a sense that I was learning, that I had insight from it. That's what you're supposed to get from tragedy, not just the pain, but in the end, recognition and insight, understanding. I hope there's some of that in this book. I think when you write a book like this, as much of an epic as this, you don't really know all that you've written, and you hope that in telling the stories more than in giving lessons, other people may get caught up in a bigger picture than we first thought we had of the 60s. I like to submit that the big picture of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and their times is the great American tragedy of the 20th century in the way that Lincoln and the Civil War and the breakdown of reason at the time of the Civil War, and yet the sense that there was more reason in Lincoln and in those years than in all of the 19th century history of America before and after that. And I think that there are great things that can come from tragedy if you're able to accept it. And I think it's very hard for Americans to have a tragic view. We like to be optimists or pessimists or liberals or conservatives, but to begin to see things as comedy and as tragedy, which I think is the better lens to look at things politically, as well perhaps as in your personal life. That's something you get when you come of age, I think, and America's just coming of age.
The book that Harris Wolford is referring to is called Of Kennedys and Kings, and it's a book that he wrote about the 1960s. Well, I'm sure you, like many other Americans, were watching the Democratic Convention last week. Who knows, maybe you were there. I haven't asked you in advance.
I was on the floor.
You were on the floor. I was out of the country and not watching it, so didn't really get to see any of it. What are some of the things that struck you most about it? And given your relationship with the Kennedys, what have you thought of Kennedy's bid for the presidency?
Well, of course, the striking thing of the convention for everyone, I think, was the high ending, the ending with a bang, not a whimper, that Kennedy did Tuesday night, Ted Kennedy. I didn't know he had that in him, to be frank. I supported him on balance, I was appalled at how unprepared he was when he began the campaign. I think the reason for that, in part, is related to some of the stories that I tell in this book, namely that he himself was spoiled by the myth of the super efficient Kennedy machine. Now, he knew that it wasn't that. He knew that there was a great deal of spontaneity and accident in it and learning on the move. But the way he was spoiled was that with both his brothers, he had seen how on the move, at the last minute, things could all be brought together, that it would come together and it would work and you'd win. John Kennedy, after the Martin Luther King affair, said, the best strategies are the result of accident, the accident of King's arrest and his response to it. But you see, the reverse of that often is true. The worst strategy can come from accident. In Ted Kennedy's case, the accidents were against him, beginning with Chappaquiddick and going on to the hostages in Iran. And somehow he kept believing right to the end that it was going to work the other way, that he would release a great deal of energy as his brothers had, and that it would come together. Now, oddly, it came together for him at the time when he renounced his candidacy and he was just representing a cause. I think that we're seeing that we saw the unmaking of Edward Kennedy in the first months of his campaign, and in his ending, we see the making of it as his own person, because he was programmed by history and by his family to be the successor to the legend, and he was coasting on the Kennedy myth, and it collapsed underneath him. And yet then at the very bottom of defeat, he picked himself up and he showed he did not run away, and he fought hard, and not always well, but he fought in a way that won respect and won some primaries, very important ones in the end, including Pennsylvania narrowly. And now I think we have I don't mean we have any purified or pure person in Ted Kennedy, but we have a man in his own right who has his own legend now, and it's going to be interesting to see what he makes of it, where he goes from here.
It was interesting to watch him continue to fight for that candidacy in spite of all the odds, after all the years of saying, I do not want to run for the presidency, I do not want that. And it was always very easy to understand, given his family history, how easy it would be to turn down any offers of the presidency. I wonder what caused that change of heart for him.
I think he wrestled all those years, most of all with death, and the other price that goes with running for the presidency. But certainly the risk of death must have been something that he had to weigh heavily and was blocking him. And he won that wrestling match, and he concluded that that was a risk that he had to take. I can't go into all the factors that must have moved him. I mean, I don't know what all the factors were that moved him. A sense that he could win against Carter, a sense it was his duty, sense the country was in trouble, sense that he could be a good president and could have effective people around him, whatever. But the big thing was deciding to take the risk. And then I think he assumed that with the polls 2-1 in his favor, once he had made the big decision, the country would respond. And then when he was asked the question, why do you want to be president? You know, I sort of sensed he was sitting there saying, well, you tell me, because for 3 times the polls and the people and the leaders of my party have been saying I should run. 3 times they've said it. Now finally I'm saying yes, and you're saying to me, why do you want to be president? Now that's no excuse for not being prepared. He himself, in his post-mortem interview I noticed a day or so ago, said that he made a mistake in not taking another month or two to think through his themes and his purposes and get them articulated well.
I've heard some of the blame for his defeat be put on his initial media advisor, whose name I don't recall, but who'd also been, I think, a vice president for one of the oil companies and was apparently more adept at handling the image of a large corporation than the image of a presidential candidate.
Smertz, I think, is his name. But
yes.
I don't buy that at all. It seems to me Ted Kennedy was responsible for those first months. He may have been advised to do things that were wrong, but what really set him back was the way his mind was conveyed to people, and it did not impress people. I think what has turned things around for him is that his mind and spirit came through Tuesday night in a way that was very impressive. Again, not as some totally vindicated or pure person, but when he used Tennyson's lines, "That which we are," I think it resonated successfully for many, many people as, in a way, his best answer to Chappaquiddick, which is to say that one of the things he was what he did at Chappaquiddick, but among the other things he is a senator who for 17 years had been effective and valiant in the Senate, and who's just been through, most of all, the ordeal of this campaign, and who's experienced what no Kennedy of our time has experienced, defeat. The Kennedys have shown that they know how to take death, but Ted Kennedy has done something which is much more familiar to most of us. Most people, it isn't death that they're facing, it's defeat, disappointment. And I think he's of a commoner breed now. He's no longer this mythical character. People know he can be beaten now. He will never be, again, the kind of threat to the party he was, in which everything was blocked in the party over the question of will Ted or won't he. He's now a very human figure. But out of his defeat and the way he faced it, and people now are arguing whether he faced it adequately with enough gallantry and graciousness on the last night with Carter. Maybe he didn't. It was hard to know his motives looking at him then, so that he's still full of questions. But I think he's very fortunate that he's ended this phase of his life well. I mean, he began badly and ended well. Think how much worse it would have been to have begun well and then ended in a whimper.
What about the party? What kind of shape do you think the Democratic Party's in now?
Not very good shape, nor is the Republican. Nor is the country. Where we go from there, we have a few months to decide in terms of how we vote in November.
Well, Harris Wolford, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your insights this afternoon with us on Fresh Air. I've been speaking with Harris Wolford, who has written a book about the 60s called Of Kennedys and Kings. And he was a special assistant to President Kennedy for civil rights. He was also Martin Luther King's lawyer. He, from 1970 to 78, served as the president of Bryn Mawr College. A few years before that, he was the president of Old Westbury College in New York, and he's now a lawyer working out of Philadelphia. Thank you again very much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Terry.
Just a few minutes, we'll be hearing a very different approach to dealing with the presidency and loyalty to your country. We'll be hearing from G. Gordon Liddy, who I spoke to about a couple of months ago on Fresh Air. So that's coming up in just about 5 minutes on Fresh Air. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Thank you. clarinetist Pee Wee Russell's version of Out of Nowhere. It's a minute after 3 o'clock now, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY FM in Philadelphia, and we're broadcasting now from a brand new studio on 6th and Ray Streets. We've just moved from our 46th Street studios, and I just want to remind you that tomorrow from 7 in the morning till 6 in the evening, we'll be having an open house for our listeners, so we're inviting you to drop down during any time of the day between 7 and 6 in the evening. Have a cup of coffee, have a donut, take a look around, say hello, and help us celebrate our new studios. So that's all day tomorrow here at WUHY. Well, coming up on Fresh Air, we're about to hear a very different point of view in terms of loyalty and patriotism from the one that was just presented by my guest Harris Wolford, who was a special assistant for civil rights to President Kennedy. We're going to hear now from G. Gordon Liddy, who said that he decided he had a debt to history, and that debt being to tell the story of his involvement in Watergate. Not to apologize, but to tell the story. So he paid this debt to history by writing a book, Will. Now, the title of Liddy's book derives from how he strengthened his will and overcame his fears. You've probably heard some of these stories, including the one about how he strengthened his will by lighting matches to his flesh without flinching or withdrawing, or how he ate a rat in order to get over his aversion to rats. Liddy was in the Army and the FBI, and became an assistant DA before moving to Washington, D.C. in 1969 to join the Treasury Department. He became the finance counsel for the Committee to Re-elect the President, where he organized the Watergate break-in, designed to bug the Democratic National Committee headquarters. Liddy was sentenced to 20 years in prison. In 1977, President Carter commuted his sentence to 8 years, and he was released in September of 77 after serving 4.5 years. Liddy is known for his loyalty, for his stamina, and his refusal to give information. But since the statute of limitations has run out on his offenses, he's discussing much of what he did. When I spoke with G. Gordon Liddy, I asked him what kind of impression he would like to leave his readers with concerning his personality and his actions and his involvement in Watergate.
You know, it's hard to sum a thing like that up, but if I must, I would say just somebody who did what he was supposed to do when he was supposed to do it, did not do what he wasn't supposed to do when he wasn't supposed to do it. And when I was in the Army, they gave out medals for conduct above and beyond the call of duty, and I don't really feel that I've done anything above and beyond. All I did was what I was supposed to.
So you'd like your image to be someone who was following their call of duty and doing their best in the service of their country and their president?
Yeah, but always bearing in mind that I don't believe in blind obedience. I believe in individual responsibility and freedom of the will and the supremacy of conscience. And I did not and would not do anything which did not accord with those. And I'm also a believer that, you know, when you do something that you think you ought to do and you know it's illegal, and I knew it was illegal, just as the, what do they call them, civil protesters or whatever,
civil disobedience
people, if they wanted to do that, that was fine. But I didn't have any respect for those who then, when they were caught or prosecuted for it, proceeded to snivel. And so I should not be heard to carry on about what occurred in my case. I was perfectly willing to accept whatever the positive benefits might have been from my courses of action, and I was perfectly willing to accept and did accept the negative ones when something went wrong. And I just think that's the way everybody ought to be.
Well, I believe your family worked hard for your release from prison.
Sure they did, yeah. Well, that they did, and they did because they felt that the term of imprisonment was excessive. And indeed, that came to be the position of the United States government. Otherwise, I would still be in.
Do you think it was excessive?
Well, I think so. In terms of the other folks, you know, mine was four times as much. And it has been no secret made of it by John Sirica that the attempt was to break me through doing it that way. And he didn't have a prayer of doing that, and in fact did not. So that being the case, I didn't see much point to it.
What's the point of keeping anyone in prison if there's no longer information that can be gotten from them?
Well, it depends. If you're in prison and you talk to other prisoners, they will be amongst the first to tell you that we still have to have prisons because there are some people out there who are very dangerous to society. And they'll say, hey, I've got a mother, a wife, a sister, whatever out there, and I don't want some mad dog rapist being able to nail them anytime he wants to. There are some people like that who are dangerous and have to be kept away. By the same token, that doesn't mean that the conditions in which those persons are kept has to be inhumane. But there's an awful lot of people in prison who really don't belong there. I think if you've got a victimless crime or a crime of, against property, somebody takes somebody else's money, I think it would be a lot more sensible from the point of view of society if they had that individual living in a restricted environment such as a halfway house or something, working and paying back the money. I think the victim would feel a lot better at getting his money back or her money back rather than sitting there saying, yeah, he's in jail and I'm not getting my money back, but my taxes are it's $13,000 a year to keep him there, you know, and there's not much point to it because the individual isn't dangerous.
When you were an assistant DA, you organized a number of drug busts, and when you first arrived at the White House, one of your priorities was to try to stop the flow of drugs in the country, and I'm sure many of the people who were arrested served long, some of them short, prison sentences because they were holding marijuana or LSD or any other drug.
I disagree with prison sentences for personal use of a drug like marijuana because there the only one who's being harmed is the individual himself or
herself.
Does
this represent a change in point of view?
No, I supported the revision of the New York law. I said that at one time, New York law was such that if you had a little bit more than a quarter of an ounce of pure sand in your hand and one marijuana seed in there, you had a felony possession. And I was amongst many who recognized that as a pretty ridiculous situation and moved to change it. On the other hand, however, I took the position, and I have not changed, that those who deal in drugs, and especially those who are in the business of what we would call harder drugs, be it cocaine, heroin, morphine, or any of those controlled substances, do constitute dangerous people because they are involved in the destruction of lives of children. Now, when it comes to marijuana, a dealer, I would say, is a danger because I'm aware of the effects of marijuana, of continued marijuana rather than just occasional experimental use, on goal orientation and things like that, which is critical among youth. And so I would not put in jail the kid who happens to have gotten a hold of a joint. But I would look for people who are selling that stuff to children because they are harming those children.
Okay, let's get back to your sense of loyalty. You were very loyal to President Nixon at the time that you were working in the White House. What was it about Nixon that you felt deserved your loyalty?
Well, I would have felt the same way were I in the service of any president of the United States. One's president is one's commander-in-chief. Whether or not one is in the same political party, I would say that Richard Nixon had no greater claim upon my loyalty than would have had I been in the Army or in the government service during the reign of Franklin Roosevelt, with whom I disagree and was a different party. But he is the commander-in-chief, and so you serve him loyally, or you resign when you feel you cannot any longer do so, such as Mr. Vance just did, which was a very honorable thing for Mr. Vance to do. He resigned when he felt he could no longer support publicly the policies of his president.
Did you feel Nixon was a good president?
Yes, I think he was very, very good, very competent president. That happens to be the judgment of those in Europe and Asia and even in Africa right now, and I think ultimately will be the judgment of history in this country. And as a matter of fact, something interesting happened when I was in Detroit about 3 days ago in preparation for a show very much like this one, Radio Call-In.